it's Oprah, I guess we have to start with a confessional of some sort. So Charlie mentioned that we've known each other for a long time, and sitting between these two people, really, I'm always reminded of this, but Charlie mentioned that I came from Oklahoma to New York, and that is true. And I've always thought, ever since coming here, really, about, you know, that line from New York, New York, if you can make it here, you can make it anywhere. And the truth is, I'm certain, that about the easiest thing in the world to do is to come from Oklahoma to New York and find your way. The real extraordinary achievement, I think, is to grow up in this city where you're challenged constantly by your awareness of extremely accomplished people. If you're in school, if you're 9 or 10 years old, at some point you realize that your friend's parents secretly want you to fail so that so that their children may succeed, and to survive that sort of that experience is beyond me. And I never thought about where you were from. You just seemed like a New Yorker. I used to read you in the New York Observer, and then I think you came to the magazine earlier than 2005.
Yeah, right? I came in 2000. Was working in the Talk of the Town for 5 years.
Right, right. And you were an editor, and then you.
It's been a long time already.
You were editing, and then you were writing talk pieces.
That's
from
right.
The beginning.
Yeah.
By that point, you had enough experience in writing about New York that it must have not felt like a jarring experience for you. But I wonder maybe it was to shift from the Observer to the New Yorker, or did you have ideas that wouldn't have worked there that worked at the New Yorker, or what?
Probably. It was certainly intimidating when it started. I mean, I remember it was August and nobody was around, and I was suddenly alone editing the section and writing for it in the same week. It was my second week there, and I didn't even know the whole process, and that was intimidating. But outside of that, it's similar. It's just it's trying to tell a story about the city. The Observer definitely is on lookout for controversy in a way that sometimes the Talk of the Town is not. Although we like controversy too, in the Talk of the Town. But the Observer sometimes was less tolerant of merely interesting stories.
Were you able to just follow your own ideas, or were you being asked to do things always? I mean,
at the Observer?
Here. Actually, yes.
The Observer, we had this brilliant relationship with the editor where we would sort of talk each other out of things constantly. So months would go by, I wouldn't write it. I'd be like, what do you think? He'd be like, I don't know. I'd say, I don't know either. 3 months later, Nick, what are you doing? I don't know. The New Yorker, I was editing this section, so, I was one of the editors, or it was a deputy editor of it, so there was a hole there, and come Thursday, Friday, had to be filled, so I couldn't talk myself or let anybody else talk.
But you knew on Tuesday that you were going to write something for Thursday.
And it had it in mind, and then would, lollygag for a little while and struggle and pull out my hair. And there's a saying when you're starting to write a story that you think is a good story and you report it, and people like to say, they now say it sarcastically, but it will write itself. Well, I feel that way almost about, every story. Oh, this one's going to be easy. It'll write itself. And it never really does.
No, and I don't think it does.
But that voice, that New Yorker voice, I guess, being from New York, studying it a little bit in school, in grade school, they were sort of inculcated with some of the stuff, the E.B. White stuff. We looked at, the cartoons I certainly looked at in dentist's offices, And so somehow that tone was there without having to, and so I picked up on that. And, over the course of the first 6 months, sort of got the hang of it a little bit. Now, still every time. Like reinventing the wheel. I imagine you might feel the same way. I'm sure that
I wasn't reading it in grade school in Tulsa, and
we weren't reading it either. We were pretending to read it.
My parents actually had one of the I think half dozen New Yorker subscriptions in town, but I never looked at it. So it was as if they didn't. I would look at the cartoons, but I never read anything, and I never intended to do this. And my senior year in college, this is true, I applied to law school because that was the default choice, and I like to think the lowest score ever on the LSAT exam. So I needed a fallback, and I'd had a good writing teacher, a quintessential New Yorker, by the way, William Zinsser. I'm sure many of you know him, and he was just a matchless teacher, wonderful man, and still alive and still writing. Had a piece in the Times yesterday, as a matter of fact, in the city section, part of a new book he's writing. And he was very encouraging to me, and then when I needed a job or needed something to do, he hired me as an editor at the alumni magazine at Yale. So I did that for a couple of years, but I knew I was coming here. And he gave me very good advice. He just said, just write in your own voice. And that's possible to do and not possible to do, because you're clearly aware that you're writing for a certain publication and a certain audience. It's supposed to be anathema to think about the audience, but you're fooling yourself if you're not imagining some reader. Although for a long time, and I think this is true of an entire generation plus of New Yorker writers, William Shawn was their audience, the editor who edited the magazine.
The audience of one.
The audience of one, and he was the audience that counted. And his curiosity about everything was immense, but he didn't ever go anywhere himself. He was quite phobic, as anybody who's read Brendan Gill can testify. And he dispatched writers everywhere, just so that, as his surrogates. So that really opened things up. And when I came here, it was all brand new to me. And I was put in an office, the same way you must have felt. I was there for 2 days, and nothing happened. And then the phone rang, and it was Mr. Shawn's assistant, who was a wonderful woman from Mississippi, named Mary Painter. And she would always call every week when you talk about having deadlines and assignments. She would say, "Mark, Mr. Shawn would like to know if you have anything for us this week." Try to. Often, it was in the summer, it was dead. Right. You know, there was, and you talk about August. I had a talk story that I wrote once about an abandoned PATH station in Chelsea. It was an 18th Street PATH station that I somehow found out about and went there with some Port Authority executives to explore this thing. And we took miners' helmets, you know, so we could read the posters on the wall. And I did this story, and it wasn't very good.
It sounds like fun, though. I mean, it didn't run.
For about 2 years, and then August rolled around, and everybody had gone to Cape Cod except for me, and so they had to stick this. I got a call from a fact checker who said, "You know, we're running your piece this week." I said, "Which piece?" And they said, "The one on the PATH train." And I said, "Ay, ay, ay." So it turned out that, of course, most of the people that I had quoted in the piece no longer worked for the Port Authority.
Right.
So this will tell you all you need to know about the New Yorker's vaunted fact-checking department. They simply took the people who had replaced them, the Port Authority, and inserted them. Same quotes, just different guys.
Yeah, and then the date on when you say when it happened, you say the other day.
The other day, right.
The other day could be 30 years ago.
And it was.
Read it all. And in this case, yeah. The other day. Yeah.
One of the things that you and I have talked about, in addition to finding things you do like to do, well, tell me first, what's your common denominator when you think you're going to go do anything? What do you?
I mean, you just have to be interested in it. I mean, I have these sort of default interests, which are, you know, borderline, you know, obsessions and
what are
insanities.
They?
I like transportation. So my eyes lit up when I heard about
the
station. Also, I like abandoned. Is it still there?
Yeah, I'm sure.
Cool. I like abandoned industrial sites, and I like transportation, and especially tri-state area transportation. So, you know, an abandoned PATH station is like the apotheosis of all my interests.
Wow.
You know, if there are hockey players in there and
well, I can tell
couple,
you it hasn't been
guitar
done well,
players in
so
there,
you can certainly go.
Great, yeah.
But you, so that's one thing. But is there anything, is there a certain kind of person that you want to write about? You write a lot about athletes. You're an athlete.
Yeah, athletes. The thing about athletes is they're sort of horribly boring. I mean, I guess I want to convert this interest in sports, the time spent watching them and caring about them, into, you know, something approaching a work product.
Right.
So occasionally I will decide, you know, I've been watching, you know, 30 hours of hockey this week. Maybe I should write something about it so that it at least it appear like I work to live and I live to work. So so I have written about athletes. I do like sports. What I like about them is what they do. I like to watch them perform and do things. Whenever you talk to one, almost without fail, it's disappointing. And it's a lot to ask of them to be interesting to talk to because, you know, they spend all their time doing things, and the things that they do require that they eliminate from their mind what we would consider to be interesting thoughts, you know.
Right.
Like, you know, self-doubt, for example. You know. All the anxieties, you know, they don't do that. And they, right. So they just kind of, and then there's the added element of, especially in today's world, I mean, I never got to write about athletes in the era when athletes would hang out with you and be regular guys in the bar and tell funny stories. And I mean, it's just a totally different era now. They may actually be interesting. They're just not allowed to be interesting. I mean, because, you know, they're media trained, and if they ever do say anything interesting, athletes, they get killed for it. I mean, you know, just the most
just
subtle.
Like Billy Wagner, the Mets pitcher last week, got in trouble for it.
Oh, he's being psychoanalyzed, and it may be true that he's a racist, and it may be true all these things. I don't know, but you know, this sort of moment of irritation he had in the locker room when, you know, he was being interviewed by the media, and, you know, all his teammates had left, leaving him to deal with the media. He said, "Why don't you interview these guys? You should be interviewing." For a week, he's a racist. You know, he's tearing the team apart, and you know.
Right.
So, you know, they learn to say, it was a tough game, tough loss, we got to move on to the next one.
But what you wrote about this guy recently, Sean Avery, the Rangers enforcer.
He's not one of those guys.
Yeah, he's not one of those guys. No. He was until he ruptured his spleen here, was going to work at Vogue.
He is working at Vogue. I hear he's been there. I half want to run into him because to see a sort of professional hockey player in the, you know, in the sort of halls of Condé Nast would be a kick.
Yeah.
And I'd like to sort of talk shop with him a little bit. I mean, you know,
talk
about hockey.
You talked shop with him though when you wrote about him. Though. Well, he must have been unbuttoned as an interviewer.
No, I didn't even talk to him. I mean,
you didn't?
I didn't talk to him. This was all just kind of hearsay. I mean, that's one of those things where he wasn't talking to the media that week, even though he sort of is this media, you know, attractor. He wasn't talking that week, so he said, forget it, we'll just write about him from a great distance, which is actually sometimes better.
So you haven't heard anything from him either?
No, so half of me is sort of, I'm thrilled to run into him.
So in the fourth floor
cafeteria. I love hockey, let's talk about hockey. But then there's also the fear that he'll be like, hey, you're the jerk who wrote about me.
No, he's going to want to talk about fashion. Can you do that? Well,
that I can't do. So my favorite, you know, I've done a few hockey things. One of them was, you know, there are several of us in the Talk of the Town who are really into hockey, and David Remnick, the editor of the New Yorker, is not into hockey. He likes sports and has, you know, he knows a lot about them and cares about them and understands, you know, the way they.
I think it has to do with his belief, and which I share, that basically Jews can't skate.
That's not true.
Okay.
I think there are three in the NHL. So, you know, you always pitch.
It's just,
you know,
my personal experience.
Schneider, he's from New York, you know. Dubinsky's not, no. But I went to a game with him recently, and he asked. He said, Dubinsky, what kind of a name is that? I think it's Polish. But this one time, he, to his credit, he said we'd been bugging about doing a hockey piece in the Talk of the Town, and the fashion issue was coming up, the style issue. And it sometimes makes him a little uncomfortable that we're doing a style issue. So he said, why don't we do an all-hockey Talk of the Town? He said, you're kidding, right? He said, no, every piece in the section should be about hockey. Well, all right, you know. So we did that. We had an all-hockey Talk of the Town.
The note and comment also?
No, we couldn't get the comment to be about hockey. Although I wish we had.
Yeah.
And so for this thing, I went to see the movie Miracle.
About the
USA hockey team, and right. I was going to write about this Russian player who was then playing in the Stanley Cup playoffs, named Igor Larionov. But when I went to go see the movie, I was playing in a hockey game that weekend, so I had to go to a store and buy a hockey stick for that weekend's game. And I was coming from the office, so I had to walk into this movie about hockey, carrying a hockey stick. I mean, you know, was there a bigger idiot in New York that day? You know, so kind of walking up, people looking at me warily. Like, what are you doing?
But you know, when you're part of what you've done is meta sports. When you wrote about the guys from WFAN,
Right.
And that's a real challenge because you're talking about someone that maybe not all the majority of New Yorker readers, but millions of people tune into this show. And so, what are your inhibitions when you know that you're dealing with something about which people are utterly opinionated, and then you're the sort of grand overseer of the opinionators?
Well, I think you would agree. I think you've said this and written it, that it's very difficult to write about someone, you know, who everybody knows about, who's been interviewed a lot, who's sort of and who spends all day talking on the radio. I mean, they've said everything they have to say about their lives. I mean, it's 6 hours a day. What could you possibly find to say about someone who's already out there all the time? Now, you know, you discover that not everyone in the world listens to WFAN, which is, you know, amazing.
Which is enormous relief.
Yeah, which is enormous relief. And there are actually people who live outside of New York who don't get New York radio, which is always astounding. But then the trick becomes trying to find something, you know, interesting to say about them. You know, like,
well, you're just a fly on the wall, though, with them most of the time.
Right, but I mean, they, you know, the weird thing about those two is that when they talk, normally they talk like they do on the radio. It's just it's a continuation of the same thing. I mean, if they're talking about which bus to take, or
but that to me is to whatever degree God is in the details of those stories, that all that accretion of color and it's not on the main topic. It's the thing that really makes it rich to read, and it really draws upon a particular ear that you have. That is, you know, attuned to just the cadences of New York speech. Did you think that you had that growing up, or did you learn it on the job?
Born with it. Born with an ear for New York speech. I don't know. I just love it. The deli talk, the radio, the sports talk radio, the sort of just the noises of New York and all that stuff. And it's in me. And I imagine you came here and discovered it, and you captured it perfectly. So you must have fallen for it. What was your opinion of the way New Yorkers talk before you came to New York?
It was all interesting. Yeah. I mean, truly. Now I since revised that opinion.
But you realize, but it just sounds interesting.
There was that thing. My picture of New York growing up was derived. I saw this city for the first time when I was 18 or 19. Mm-hmm. So before that, it was Naked City. Mm-hmm. And there was the Defenders, that Saturday night TV show, mm-hmm. Ed Sullivan, mm-hmm. and I can't think of anything else offhand. West Side Story, that made a big impression on me. But when I came here, what I realized was that I was just ready for anything, because I wasn't going to find the Defenders and West Side Story. They were gone, and I had to find something new. And I just found that whatever people had to say, especially when they were talking about what they really cared about, was great. It was just great copy. And I became concerned that I wasn't getting dialogue down as accurately as possible, because it's impossible to do, actually. You can use it. You know, people use tape recorders, and you and I have discussed that. It's very labor-intensive. You actually have to listen to the tape.
Transcribe it.
And then taking notes. I mean, I went and took shorthand at the New School, which made some difference. But
does shorthand work for sort of idiosyncratic dialogue?
Evidently not, because I quit doing it.
But, you quit doing it, yeah.
No, it does up to a point. And you develop your own little tricks. But I also found that if I would rush back to my desk as soon as I'd done interviewed anyone, and that I would then hear the conversation pretty well again. I approach all these things with insecurity. You know, I'm going to blow this. This is not going to work. And so I take more notes when I need to. And you know, whereas Lillian Ross, the by far New Yorker talk of the town contributor of longest standing, I'm told doesn't even take notes. And it's kind of like Truman Capote, you know, within Cold Blood. He did not take notes. He would go back and download to Harper Lee in the hotel room at the end of a day in talking to these guys in prison. And so Lillian does that, you know, and nobody ever complains, I don't think, that she got it wrong.
You know, they go over, the fact checkers go over everything, you know, so that the facts are in place.
Yes.
It's almost like a recapitulated conversation.
Yeah, but it's, I mean, that was the attraction. And also, I wanted to get away from Manhattan. once I got here, there were certainly many things to write about in Manhattan, but I just, it was that thing of, I would rather be doing anything than pack journalism. In other words, where I'm somewhere where there are other reporters present is to me the worst of all possible situations. And you have to do it every now and then. It's unfortunately the case. But I was operating on the assumption that nobody famous was ever going to say anything to me that they had not said before, or that I was going to ask a question that they had not been asked before. And So I just sort of went to Brooklyn a lot. I went to all the outer boroughs, not so much Staten Island, but I was really looking for these sort of under the radar stories. They were what would, I guess, pass as quote unquote human interest or feature stories. But you know, it was finding like a pigeon vendor, pigeon exchange in Greenpoint that I could see from the BQE. I could see the sign, you know, Meeker Pigeon Exchange, and I went in there one day and just hung out for hours, and what came out of it was something, you know, that Damon Runyon wouldn't have minded. You know, it was really, that was the way those guys sounded when they talked, and I wasn't making it up. It was really rich. And
New York is too good to be true all the time. I mean, I was telling you the other day.
Oh, yeah, tell that story about what happened to you. This is great.
I was doing a talk with the Town Piece last week, and, this is how it happened. A friend of mine's on a bus, thank God for Blackberries. It's like the universal assignment desk. This friend of mine's on a bus, and it's an old Mercedes. It's a brand new, super fancy Mercedes bus, but everything on it is in German. It's a test bus. There's only one of them in the city, and it's sort of working its way around Manhattan. And she writes, "Oh, this is incredible. Everyone's confounded by the German. The thing's broken down. Everyone's talking to each other about German, and there's all kinds of opinions. People are getting in arguments." I said, "Oh, there's probably a Talk of the Town piece in that." So I call the MTA, I find out where the bus is going to be the next day, I go catch it, I ride on the bus, and of course, as ever, you know, New Yorkers' gift that keeps on giving, they're just saying funny things, talking about the bus or whatever else, and it's just this great urban poetry.
You're writing all this down?
Yeah, writing it all down, yeah. And people wondering what I'm doing, and I tell them, and since I won't be using names or anything, a lot of the time they don't mind that I'm going to, you know, write it down. And so, you know, we're going along just another one of these, you know, another day of urban poetry in New York, and then just as I'm about to sort of give up and say this will be fine, giving up meaning it's going to be okay, I'm interviewing the bus driver about the bus, and sitting right behind the bus driver is this man who just starts in a sort of Rain Man kind of way talking about bus depots and bus plants. You know,
he's just a bus savant.
He turns it. It took me a while to realize it. At first, I said, "Who's this kook? I got to get away from him." Here I am, the journalist, and I'm like, "Ew, he's weird." And then he announces that he's the photographer for the Bus Industry magazine, and I said, "Oh, you are," and you know, and it turns into one of these gifts of the nonfiction gods. The guy turns out to know more about buses than any man you'll ever meet. He's spent his entire life, 60 years, obsessing about buses. Used to ride around New York on buses with his mother when they were, you know, he was a child. Every weekend they'd go on bus rides at the end of the line just to see where they'd go. And then they started traveling to other cities to see what the buses were like there. He was a bus savant. And here he's dropped into my lap, you know. And of course everybody thinks you're making it up, but we're not. Not this one. No, sir. It's fact check.
And it's in the magazine this week, right?
It's in the magazine this week. I was going to say something, I can't remember what it was, but anyway, it was
Well, when that happens, I think it's very exciting. You know, you can have done this for years and years and years, but when you find that person and you know that I'm going to do this in 800 words.
Right.
I got to do it. There's a deadline. Right. This is no kidding around here.
Right.
You get a real charge. You get a lot of adrenaline, and it doesn't quite write itself, but you are not.
That was as close as it's ever come to writing itself.
Yes.
But what I was going to say was, though, that this was so fascinating, and you get so wrapped up in it, and you start thinking about this whole guy's life, this sort of spanning the decades, mid-century man, you know, with the 21st century bus, and you think about his mother and the whole Ralph Cramden show and everything, and you say, this is a piece, this is a longer piece.
Oh, yeah.
And that happens, you know, every third or fourth talk piece.
And how did you overcome that?
I now have an inner governor, which says, "Oh, there you go again." You know, no. But then, you know, an editor, Susan, she was fascinated. She said, "Maybe this is a longer piece." I said, "No, get out, get out, get out, get out, get out. I got to file this." And so,
Well, it's happened.
You've done that.
Well, it happens different ways. I went to a talk of the town story a long time ago. I can't remember. It was about in the late 70s. And I was. It was the building superintendents of New York had an association.
Oh.
And I was introduced to these five brothers, all of whom managed, all of whom supered in Upper East Side apartment buildings. And they were the Brennan brothers. And I wrote the story about them. And they appeared as a sort of cameo in this story. And then Mr. Sean said, you know, this could be a longer piece. And
did the Talk of the Town piece run?
It ran.
Okay,
but then I went back and did the this. And, you know, you're writing a profile of five people now. So there's a lot of it's labor intensive. And but I went to, you know, their christenings. I went to birthday parties. I you know, spent St. Patrick's Day, you know, with them. I went to the parades. I'm still in touch with a couple of them. And
how long did it take?
It's a good question. I think it probably. I used to spend. This is a different era of the magazine, which it's hard to explain now that it ever existed. But I probably spent a year and a half on that. You know, and again, that was just the amount of
living the dream.
Well, I can tell you what it was not. It was a good way to make a living.
No. But, it still isn't. Yeah.
Words is money, and this was not a lot of words at a rapid clip. But it was something that I was glad I did. And that was one of those things that was, you know, quintessentially what I had no clue about when I first got here that I then, you know, felt that I was a part of because this family sort of took me in. I want to ask you about a couple of pieces of yours that ran recently within the last year, and they struck me as impossible pieces to write. And I remember seeing you while you were writing one of them, and you agreed with me at the time.
Yeah, you helped reassure me that my feeling that it was impossible was not absolutely insane.
No, I said that you were going to come through it, but it was very, very difficult, right? And it's okay to feel sorry for yourself.
Yeah, it's good.
Yeah. So these were Mort Zuckerman and Elliot Spitzer, and the Elliot Spitzer piece in retrospect, of course, is bizarrely prescient. You know.
I guess, yeah.
Well, really,
it's one way of looking at it. Yeah. Yeah. The other is that, you know, I missed the big story. From now on, whenever I talk to a political figure, the first question is, "So, hookers? You into them?" Yeah. Okay, no, don't lie to me. But in some ways, yeah, there were elements of it, I guess, that foretold, you know, the difficulty of the man.
Well, the difficulty from a reporter's perspective of just being with the guy. How is that?
He's intense. I mean, the strange thing is that everybody I talked to about him, and him included, basically would say about him, and he would say about himself, that he was uninteresting, that he had no inner life. Mm. I mean, he didn't say, "I have no inner life," but he said, "I'm really uninteresting. I don't believe in psychoanalysis or being psychoanalyzed."
And all his friends
would say, "What you see is what you get." I mean, it was, you know, and I wrote this. against my better judgment, because knowing that everybody is dark and complicated, and you know, that everybody does have a strange and interesting inner life, in this one instance, I decided, you know, maybe this is the one guy that doesn't. You know, I'm not going to psychoanalyze this.
No, but actually, you were talking.
But
yeah,
of
about
course,
this,
I can't help it.
There was blunder
writer.
After blunder in that first year.
Yeah, and you're spending time with someone, and you're wondering, you know, these sort of, you know, extreme type A guys for me are a source of endless fascination.
Okay, so like Mort Zuckerman. So Mort Zuckerman. What was that one?
Zuckerman, another guy who's sort of, again, another guy that obviously has a more complicated inner life than one is allowed to see, or one is really even allowed to articulate in a direct way. You have to articulate it indirectly. But
the lack of modesty, does that become difficult for you to deal with?
Yeah. What do you mean? you've talked about sort of the drifting into the background and getting to the point with the subject where you know, they don't quite realize you're there.
Correct.
I mean, he obviously did realize it was there all the time, but
you had to play tennis with him.
I played tennis with him, yeah. He knew I was there then. Oh, yeah.
But
the work in his backhand.
But when you...
In fact, that was a lot... After that, my shoulder went on the fritz. I didn't play again for 6 months. I had to get surgery. And so I have a bone to pick with Mort beside everything else, you know.
And then you never know how people will react also. In his case?
The subject, yeah. I mean, I never heard from him. I never heard from him after that. You know, I'd spent a lot of time with him. And, you know, he really didn't want this story to happen. And, you know, strangely, I didn't really want to do it either. And we had, you know, it's like the opposite of The Observer, where we talk each other out of things. We sort of, you know, this thing just happened.
So, wait a minute. He didn't want it to happen, and as obviously someone at The New Yorker wanted it to happen,
yeah.
But you didn't want it to happen either.
Well, I mean, the fascination was there. And,
oh, it was?
You know, I mean, not the fascination, but the interest was there. And there's sort of that journalistic imperative to get your man, at a sort of, you know, to seal the deal, to get someone to talk to you. And, you know, it's...
So you've never written a piece that you truly didn't want to write or that you resisted?
That would qualify. Those two, in some ways, but in the end, it was good. I mean, you know, David Remnick is a fan of the sort of big, obvious profile.
Sure.
And sometimes the writers resist that because they want to do the sort of strange little thing that they're obsessed with. But, you know, it turns out time and again that he's actually right. He will have you do something that you resist, and there it is, you know, something that people want to talk about and want to hear about.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's happened to you. You've been forced to do a couple stories that you didn't really want to do.
That's true. And at the end of the day, I can't think of any that I didn't want to do that I ended up really regretting doing. The one that surprised me the most this was actually not Remnick, but Tina Brown. Was Donald Trump, and there was absolutely nothing about that appealed to me. And I actually went around, you know, she stopped me and she said, "Trump, you've got to do him." And she called me up actually, and she said, "I just came from breakfast with him, and and you're going to love him. He's completely full of shit, and it'll be great." And so
you're going to love it.
And she told him the same thing. "This guy's the greatest. You're going to love him." And but when she first asked me to do it, I owed her. I had been on a book leave, and I really had to pay her back. So I checked around with people in the office. All of them said, "Don't do it, don't do it." But I didn't have the choice. So I went to see him, and we, you know, met in his office. And then I spent much less time at this point because you know, the ground, the standards had changed. I don't remember how many months I spent on it, but it was not a lot. I could figure it out, but the point is, I wrote this piece. I had to go, you know, various places in New York with him, and I had to go to Mar-a-Lago with him, and where I was, by the way, the coldest I've ever been in my life, Palm Beach in March, when you don't expect the weather to be that way.
And what year was that?
'97.
And shivering in a hotel in Florida.
I was shivering. One night, I was you know, I was in this suite. I remember the sign said $1,000 a night. I don't know who was paying for it, not me. And I was in fetal position in my bed, you know, trying to get warm. And the phone rang, and it was his butler saying, you know, "Mr. Trump has been out to a movie, and he's come back, and he's going to watch another, he's going to watch this boxing match on television." So in this big ballroom, there was a huge screen that came out of the ceiling, and I don't remember much about the match, but Marla Maples was there, and I do remember asking her how she felt about boxing. I said, "You know, do you like boxing?" And she said, I like it a lot, just as long as no one gets hurt." And so I wrote this piece, and I didn't have an ending for it. And I literally faxed this thing in to my editor at the time, and I said, "Look, I we'll figure out an ending, but I don't have it now, or it's a week." This is before I was emailing things anyway, so I was faxing it. I got in bed. I had a clock radio on my bedside table, turned on WCBS, and heard that Donald Trump and Marla Maples were splitting up, which, talk about missing Elliot Spitzer. I had not seen this coming. But it turned out to be a great gift, and that weekend I just rewrote the lead, and it ended up, it was actually one of my... We talked about leads a lot. It was the lead I know began.
That's a great
I went
lead.
To see him I went to see him in his office, and I wouldn't have gotten in if I hadn't been writing this piece otherwise, so I guess I called him Monday morning and got in there. And I said, one morning last week, Donald Trump, who under routine circumstances, I can't remember. It's like, I could find
Thank
it
God,
here.
I
could
find impressed it. Impressed if you could reveal that one.
Hold on. Bear with me. Just my brain.
Yeah,
one morning last week, Donald Trump, who under routine circumstances tolerates publicity no more grudgingly than an infant tolerates a few daily feedings, Saturday
right, right, right.
And you find that you get a great deal of momentum when you can find a lead that works.
And gets to the heart of the matter really quickly.
But everybody knows this guy, and so I wrote the piece, and I really tried to figure out how he did what he did. Mm-hmm. And I decided, obviously the most brilliant thing he did was to brand himself, which truly ingenious. I don't remember anyone having done it before. But all these buildings that had his name on them, they're all over this neighborhood and in other parts of the city. They don't belong to him. You know, they're condos that have been sold off, and he's retained rights to the parking or something. And it was true over here at across the park at the Trump International Hotel right near Columbus
Circle.
Gulf and
Western building, right.
And it had his name on it, which is what sold the building. But he literally there had, he only had the back end of the deal, and he had the parking concession. And so I pointed that out in the piece, and he didn't care for that. And and he had talked to me, he had these categories that were luxury, super luxury, and super super luxury, and I was interested in the question you were preoccupied with was, does he have an interior life? And I asked him one day, what he did in the morning, when he got up, what time do you get up? Trump has never had a drink in his life. He doesn't sleep very much, and he has a lot of energy. Doesn't exercise, but he's up very early. And I said, what time do you wake up? I wake up at like 6, 5:30, 6. I said, what time are you at your desk? And he said, 7:30 or whatever. And I said, so what do you do when you're still home? You read stuff. What do you read? And, the Times, the Journal, whatever. And I said, now you're in the bathroom now, and you're shaving, and you're looking in the mirror, and you see yourself. And this is a person who is nothing if not a narcissist. So you're looking in the mirror, and I said, do you say to yourself, wow, I'm Donald Trump? And he couldn't answer the question. And I said, well, do you consider yourself ideal company? And he said, you want to know what I consider ideal company? And I said, what? And he said, something that was completely vulgar that involved, which is being with a woman.
Right.
So I wrote the piece. Toward the end, I had hit on this idea that he didn't have an interior life that I could detect. And so
you might have been right in this case.
I just said, most important, this was about Trump's living space. Every square inch belonged to, Trump, I know. I'm just describing him, Trump at the end. Trump, who'd aspired to and achieved the ultimate luxury, an existence unmolested by the rumbling of a soul. And,
He didn't like that.
actually, some reviewers, this was in a book, and a couple of reviewers pointed out that this was impossible empirically. How would I know that he didn't have a soul? And they were right. But he complained to Tina Brown in a letter that, she told him that he was going to love me, and he didn't. And that he's going to love the piece. And so he felt very betrayed. He published a book in which he attacked me, mainly my looks.
I love his description of you.
A faint wise guy sneer and a chip on my shoulder was
right.
How he described
but,
it.
But before that, it was an aspect of what, a nothing or something?
Yeah,
like
he walked, he said, the minute I walked into his office, he could tell that I was not much of anything.
Not much of anything.
Not much of anything.
Which, of course, it's exactly
it's
what
true.
You're trying to do.
And
which may be true.
Because
huge
I had,
inner life, but other
well,
than
I had,
that.
I had disappeared into the woodwork so that I was undiscernible.
Right.
And but then I published this piece in this book, and it was reviewed in the Times, Sunday Book Review, by a guy who liked the book and said nice things about me, but he took issue with the Trump profile. He said this guy was too easy a target. He had neither the wit nor the foot speed to defend himself. And
pity the poor billionaire.
So then 2 weeks later, the Times published this letter from Trump, in which he said, you know, this guy was a lousy writer, and I was a lousy writer, and actually he knew because he was a best-selling author, and he had read John Updike and Orhan Pamuk and Philip Roth, and when I could write like them, then he might deign to read me again. But it just went on and on. It was really incredibly vitriolic, and I couldn't have asked for anything better. I had checked my Amazon listings, you know, ranking for that book the week before, and I was not good. And then he attacked me, and it shot up.
Right.
You know, and so I wrote him a letter, and I thanked him. And I said, you know, dear Donald, thank you. A lot of people have told me that your letter was one of the funniest things they read in a long time. And I had decided, I wanted to, how could I thank him really? And I said, you know, he likes money. Right. So I'm going to give him some money. And I thought, I'm going to send him $1,000 because I wanted him to cash the check. And then I thought about it, and I thought, I don't really want to send him $1,000. So I sent him a check for $37.82. And I said, this is a small token of my appreciation. You know, I know people are not supposed to give money to the people who review their books, which I was suggesting that his letter was a review. And but you know, you're so special to me. And I said, I enclosed this check, and I also enclosed two Band-Aids. I said, because you seem unable to stop picking at this scab, these should come in handy.
Right.
And well, you know, the pen, it's fair game, I think, at that point. And so 2 weeks later, I get back my letter, Trump Organization envelope embossed, and he's just taken my letter and written on it in big, he said, Mark, you are a total loser, and your book and writings sucks. and he said, sincerely, Donald. And he said, P.S., and I hear it is selling very badly, which was absolutely true by that point. And I later was able
for
to
for a moment
to,
he was not full of
write
shit.
About that. And he cashed the check. That was
of course. Of course he did.
Yeah. And when I wrote about it, I said evidently he needed the money.
Right.
So it worked out well. And I wouldn't have imagined that I would have enjoyed anything about that.
And again, another gift that keeps on giving.
Yeah, yes.
Yeah.
Maybe we should take questions at some point.
Sure.
Yeah, we're ready.
Why 37.82?
Why not?
It's a funny number.
It's a number. I mean, I thought about it, you know, and this is what I consider.
Can you tell us Charlotte? About some nice people
who
really love quantities?
Oh, yes. The Brennan brothers. I wrote, when I first came, the first profile I wrote was of my great uncle, whom I had not met before I came here, who was an old TV, a radio performer and TV comedy writer named Goodman Ace. And I'd known of him because I was growing up. He was my step-grandmother's brother. But he was part of what I identified with New York. But I came here and became sort of like if you remember that relationship in the Sunshine Boys between the nephew who's taken care of. I can't remember if it's, you know, Walter Matthau or Jack Lemmon, but it was very much that. And no, I wrote a profile of him that was utterly affectionate, and I've continued to do so. The piece I wrote after that, the next profile, was of a court buff in Brooklyn, a guy who just went and watched murder trials every day. He was a retired bow tie salesman, and he would go to the state Supreme Court building in Brooklyn, and so for months I went over there and hung out with him and his fellow court buffs. I've rarely written about someone that I didn't truly have affection for. That was why I resisted that one in particular.
Well, I guess my question is, are there big figures that we could really admire?
Well, one of the people that I was asked to write about.
I was kidding.
No, I said at one point, I absolutely will not do another celebrity famous person piece. I've had it. Please don't make me do that. And they said, okay, okay, we understand. And then like 2 days later, called me up and said, Martin Scorsese. And I couldn't resist because I'm such a great admirer of his. But I had to go read everything that had been written about him. You know, it took weeks to do just that so that I wasn't going to ask these questions that were obvious. And still, you're doing that. But he turned out to be truly the most interesting, I guess, as interesting as anyone I've ever written about. And because his brain, the stream of consciousness of his brain was what the subject of the piece was. And he remembers every movie he's ever seen. He remembers credits. He remembers lighting. He remembers, who did the sound on these. These are not movies that he made. These are movies that he just saw, you know, as a child, and camera angles, and throughout his films, there are all these homages to all these different films that he has seen across the years. So that was bottomlessly rewarding.
Well, he's a film savant, really.
Yes,
he
is a film savant.
Who has been given, a job.
That's true.
To make films.
That's true.
I mean, it's kind of wonderful. You find those people where there's the confluence of, the sort of lunatic on the bus or the lunatic in the neighborhood who also is a genius who's getting work.
Right. But what he had in common with your guy on the bus and with other people that I've written about it, and this is actually the book that I turned out after this, was about people who are obsessed. Mm-hmm. And so I wrote a series. I just put together a book that was Encounters with the Curiously Obsessed, mm-hmm. was the idea of that. Because you can't go wrong with anyone who cares that much.
And the city is full of them. I mean, it's where people come in the way to be obsessed.
Yes.
There's certainly a reason.
You mean because you wrote the piece? That's
well, yeah.
Yeah.
But actually, when it happened,
The New Yorker put it right on its website, too. That was that week.
They put the piece back on their website.
They put it,
and I did a little Talk of the Town piece. But yes, I mean, obviously, to be the person who talks to him, and one would hope talks to him first about, does this say, so what the hell? And then go from there. I mean, obviously, he's gone through an extraordinary couple of months here. I mean, besides the fact that the rise and fall, the classic tragic story, would be a great one to tell. Although, I don't want to be the one to once again write about the rise because it's been written about so much. But the fall is interesting. But it also, just to sort of see Eliot Spitzer in exile would be a great piece. And question is, will he do it? And,
Oh, so you're sort of thinking that that's something you would want to do.
I would. I mean, I wouldn't. In the same way, I really wouldn't be dying to do it, but I feel like I should. I mean, if I were a normal journalist, if I were like a regular, healthy.
Well, that's an interesting point.
I really should want to speak to this guy, so I'm obeying that inner voice.
So you're not uncomfortable with being uncomfortable.
No, I'm uncomfortable with being uncomfortable about being uncomfortable. So, and then by the time I figure it out, I'm writing about Eliot Spitzer again. So, he's going through a lot. I think there's a question as to whether I could be the one to speak to him. But stay tuned. It's too soon. It's too soon, and his father's very ill. He's been dealing with that. His marriage is obviously in a difficult state, and his family, the whole thing. I mean, so yeah, I mean, it's pretty intense for him. But it must be interesting for him, I have to say, to be a guy who courted publicity and dealt with the press every day for whatever it was, a dozen years, building a career basically in the public eye, talking to the press every day. And when I saw him as governor, I mean, everywhere he went, there were 15 people around him. He had this whole bring it on mentality. I mean, they'd be trying to pull him away from the scrum of the press, asking him about the illegal alien licenses for illegal, undocumented aliens, whatever. And he couldn't walk away from it. And yet now, it's been 2-3 months of just total silence for him. I mean, it must be sort of almost a traumatic experience for him. That alone, just the sort of his brain chemistry must be changing as he sort of. Learns to have normal discussions and not have to present himself to the world every 30 seconds.
Well, after 50 years of reading the magazine, I noticed that there
Well, how many corrections do you see in Pravda? You know. We do not make mistakes in the New Yorker. Yeah, I mean, I probably shouldn't even say this, but I wrote a talk piece recently about a guy, George Lois, I can't believe I'm saying this, in which he claimed to have invented a lot of these advertising slogans. And then a week or two later, the New York Times ran a piece, Chip McGrath wrote it, and it was very similar. You know, George Lois saying the same things about his career. And, you know, since after the talk piece ran, I sort of got a letter from someone saying, you know, George Lois's story isn't, you know, totally right on the money. And that guy subsequently this weekend sent me an email with a correction that the Times ran. You know, that George Lois did not invent the I Want My Maypo campaign.
Right.
Now, you know, we haven't quite taken it up at the New Yorker, and maybe, I don't know.
People are
I don't know if we will.
How many weeks ago was it? It was 4 weeks ago.
It was the other day. It was the other day.
Yeah. Peter Barney, David Remnick. It seems to me there's a certain continuity of style and discipline of writing and so forth, but there must be pretty significant changes otherwise.
My experience with the person who was the editor of the New Yorker was, you know, started with Mr. Sean, and I think he was the editor for 13 years. My first 13 years there, and he had this wonderfully generous way of just letting writers find what it was they wanted to write about and take as long as they wanted. It seemed like such a gift, this sort of laissez-faire approach, and it turned out that it was also quite manipulative, and that when he was removed as editor by the Newhouses, who bought the magazine a couple of years earlier, the writers all en masse basically wrote a letter to Robert Gottlieb, who was coming in next, you know, been the editor-in-chief of Knopf. He had edited books that many of us had published, and we asked him not to come. What the hell were we doing? I mean, we thought we owned the magazine. We were living in Jonestown, basically, is what I later concluded. And I've talked to many New Yorker writers who said that this was kind of a cult of personality. It wasn't that Mr. Sean wasn't a great editor, but this idea that there was only one person who could understand how to publish this magazine or what how to deal with writers was nutty. And so someone asked me years later about when Robert Gottlieb had come in, what the difference was between those two, and I said, the difference is that Mr. Sean believed that writers were children who should be indulged, and the Gottlieb thinks that they're children who should not be indulged. And then after he had been there 5 years, Tina Brown came in, and that was a sea change. It became a weekly. It became a news weekly, but it became a news weekly as if before it had been a literary quarterly. I mean, the rate of acceleration was astounding, and she was interested in a whole lot of things, but among them was just a really canny business sense of how to make this something that people talk about and that advertisers want to advertise in because it was losing money for so long. And she definitely succeeded at that. She had a high-low idea of what the magazine should be that offended a lot of people because she was interested in just really tawdry stuff. And then she would, you know, publish, you know, Simone Schama and, you know, and John Updike and all those others. And she didn't seem that there was any contradiction in that you give some readers this and some readers that, but they all sort of come together. And after 6 years, David Remnick replaced her, and I never see anything coming, so I didn't know that she was going to leave. And Remnick is someone who I regarded so highly. He just is an extraordinary journalist. I mean, this is a guy who has kind of done everything, but he'd kind of done everything by the time he was in his mid-30s. I mean, I think he won the Pulitzer when he was 38 or 39 for Lenin's Tomb. And he was very modest, and he'd been a sports writer, he'd been a foreign correspondent, he'd done it all, but one of us. In fact, I saw him the day that he, you know, the day after he'd won the Pulitzer, and he was wearing shorts and sneakers in the office. And I knew that his parents, you know, were his two parents who were not in very good health. He grew up in New Jersey. His father was a dentist. So I said, you know, David, what did your parents say about the winning the Pulitzer Prize? And he said, you know what they said? And he said, what? He said, they said Morty and Sylvia Abramowitz are gonna plot. So he was definitely, you know, one of us, but he was somebody who was utterly accessible. But I also when he got the job, I said to him, you know, I don't have any advice for you except just be the boss, which turned out he has no difficulty being. He is a tough guy now and not as gentle, and I'm in awe of him the way I was of any editor of the magazine, really. And it's become as good a magazine. This is very self-serving to say. I think it's as good as it's ever been. I wasn't around during the golden age in the 30s and 40s, but if you pick it up, just this week's issue with your talk piece, and there's an Updike story and this wonderful review by, and there's Woody Allen Casual in there, Shouts and Murmurs. And
piece on Hangovers.
And a piece on Hangovers by Joan Acacella, though, yeah. Who was a really serious writer. Thinker.
Yeah.
And Ian Fraser has written about this soup kitchen where in Chelsea, where he has led a writer's workshop for almost 20 years. And there's everything there. And nobody ever quite figured out how to make this formula work as well as David has.
Yes.
And he is accessible. I mean, you talk about a boss, but he's a very accessible guy. Definitely. I mean, he's not the sort of typical magazine impresario that you see in the movies, and the Condé Nast, actually, the company cultivates. They want their editors generally to be, you know, to have 17 assistants and to use the car service as much as possible and all that.
Right.
That kind of behavior does not come easily to him, and he kind of rejects it. So.
One thing I will say, and it goes back to this question about letters of correction, corrections of the he is not someone who readily acknowledges error. It might be he'll learn.
Don't send in a note asking for a correction, because the torrents of the New Yorker will open upon you. And you'll just be, okay, you're right. You were right.
Well, we said we'd be just about an hour, so I think we'd like to thank you
Bravo.
Both very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
You know, when you mentioned the brothers, the supers.
Yes.